Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Mini Med Pods with myself, Simran, and Xiao. Today, we're going to be talking about a really interesting topic and quite a confusing topic for me, actually. It's congestive heart failure, or also known as congestive cardiac failure. And Xiao is going to be talking us through everything that you need to know about this to pass your exams and just to have a basic idea of what this is and how to recognize it. So Xiao, I'm going to give it to you.
Thank you so much, Simran. Yeah, congestive heart failure is one of those topics that does trip people up a little bit. I found it particularly difficult when I was in third year because not only did you have acute presentations, but you also were dealing with a chronic condition, and the chronic condition can appear for its first time and have a workup, and then it also has different workups if it's acute decompensation. And then you have compensated patients who look completely fine, but are just here for a tune-up. So in terms of the unique challenges of the congestive heart failure patient case, like I talk about, it's a chronic condition and it will have acute presentations. And in hospital, that's what you're mainly going to see. But they sometimes can throw you curveballs in OSCEs and actually send you a patient with congestive heart failure that's completely compensated and all you need to do is just do a checkup. Other things is heart failure is almost like an umbrella condition. We can think of what heart failure looks like, but what caused the heart failure and what caused the decompensation is something that we need to learn how to investigate as doctors, and it can be challenging to figure out from time to time because there is just such a long list of reasons why a patient has come to see us. Another thing to think about is the management process. So again, because you've got a chronic condition, you need to be able to manage them during the acute phases as well as the maintenance phases as well. So hopefully by the end of this podcast, you'll be able to understand how congestive heart failure actually happens. I'll try to explain the physiology of a normal heart and then compare that to the heart of a person with congestive heart failure. Perhaps give you an idea as to how to brainstorm the possible factors contributing to the patient's heart failure, as well as understanding what might force them to present at an acute decompensated state. Then understand the acute management of decompensation and also the maintenance therapy of heart failure. Okay, so it will be a little bit today, but just bear with me. I'll try to step through it one by one step at a time. So let's talk about the physiology of the heart. I really like the heart because it's quite simple and classic. It's basically two pumps under the same roof. So you've got the left systemic circulation and the right pulmonary circulation. So basically the right heart is the pump for the blood that goes to the lungs, and then the left heart is the pump that pushes the blood that circulates around the whole body. For a pump to work, it needs to be able to fill up properly and it needs to be able to squeeze blood properly. And basically, the maintenance and the balance of the volume going into each heart system, so not only does the heart need to control and balance its own circulation, it also needs to, as a whole, balance the pulmonary and the systemic circulation as well. Yes, there's less of blood in the pulmonary system than the systemic circulation. However, the ratio needs to be the same. And through that balance, we're able to maintain normal heart function. So how does heart failure happen? Well, heart failure happens when one of these functions stop working. So either you've got a fill problem or a squeeze problem. In the past, we sort of thought of heart failure as a left or right-hearted side problem, but now we've moved on from that. We are moving towards a fill problem and a squeeze problem. So what do I mean by a squeeze problem? Well, you've probably already heard of HFrEF. HFrEF is heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. That just simply means that the heart is unable to squeeze properly and it's not able to squeeze the majority of the blood in the ventricles, therefore reducing its ejection fraction. Now, how do I put this into sort of like a step-by-step process? Well, the normal ejection fraction in a person is about 50 to 70%. So let's think about a normal heart that usually has the capacity to fill up to 100 mils. And let's just think about it in terms of one ventricle. So if the normal person's heart is able to squeeze out 60% of that 100 mil, that means your ejection fraction is 60%. Because how you figure it out is the amount that's squeezed out, so the systolic volume, over the end diastolic volume, which is the amount that it can fill, that I've told you is 100 mil, times 100 to get a lovely percentage. So we've got 60% here. In HFrEF, heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, it's basically defined by an ejection fraction that's less than 40%. So now with a patient with HFrEF, their heart's able to fill up to 100 mils, which is normal. However, instead of being able to squeeze 60 mils, it's now only able to squeeze out 25 mils. So this, we've got a squeeze problem. And this squeeze problem results in an ejection fraction of only 25%. And that's how you classify heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. On the flip side, you've also got HFpEF, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. This is not a squeeze problem, it's a fill problem. So the squeezing ability is not affected. The ratio of the amount of the blood the ventricle can squeeze out is still exactly the same. However, now the ventricles are too small, so we're going to get a subsequent filling problem. So let's go back to the normal heart sort of situation again. So a normal heart can store up to 100 mils, and when it squeezes, or its stroke volume is 60 mils, so normal ejection fraction 60%. Now we've got a small heart that reduces the end diastolic, I've reduced the end diastolic volume to 50 mils to make it easier for us. So the ratio is still the same, it can still squeeze out 60%. But 60% of 50 mils is only 15 mils. So can you sort of see how there's going to be an issue? Because now the stroke volume is only 15 mils. And that means that the amount of volume that your heart is able to pump out is so small, because there's just so little blood in the pump to begin with. That's why HFpEF is a fill problem.
So basically what I'm understanding from what you're saying is that heart failure can be divided into HFrEF and HFpEF. HFrEF is heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, which means that it's a squeezing problem. So the heart is able to fill with blood, but the heart is not able to pump effectively enough to squeeze that blood out into the circulation. Whereas HFpEF is heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So the heart is able to squeeze, the pumping action is okay, but the actual amount of blood that fills in the ventricles or in the chambers of the heart is much smaller. And so even though the heart is able to effectively squeeze out blood or pump effectively, there's not enough blood in the heart to actually pump out.
That's exactly right. That's really good. Yeah. And look, there's going to be little nuances, because sometimes you can have blends of mechanisms of error. But this is just a simple and basic way to think of ways to differentiate HFrEF and HFpEF. Now, on the podcast, and whilst you guys are listening to it, whether you're on your walk or your car, HFrEF and HFpEF sounds really similar. So I'm going to give them colloquial names, and I'm just going to say squeeze problem and fill problem. So just to remind you again, HFrEF is a squeeze problem and HFpEF is a fill problem. So now that we know the difference between squeeze problem and fill problem, the question is, what causes it in the first place? Squeeze problem by far is probably what you're going to see in hospitals, because people with reduced ejection fraction get very, very sick, and they get very sick quickly. So HFrEF, or the squeeze problem type heart failure, can be caused by a multiple number of conditions, including having a previous acute myocardial infarction, or coronary artery disease. It can also be caused by high blood pressure. It can be caused by valvular problems. It can also be caused by dilated cardiomyopathy and, in rarer cases, arrhythmias as well as fluid overload. On the other hand, heart failure with fill problems is usually caused by high blood pressure as well as hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And that makes sense because when you have hypertrophy of the myocardium, then you're going to fill the ventricles with lots and lots of cardiac tissue, which means there's less space for blood to fill the ventricles.
That makes sense. So I just have a question, Shell. There are these two terminologies, like preload and afterload. Can you kind of give some information on like what's the definition of these things and like how does it relate to heart failure?
Most definitely. So preload and afterload definitely are words that get thrown around with heart failure a lot. And they can be kind of confusing because preload and afterload can sometimes refer to two different things that are very, very loosely related to one another. So let's start with preload. Preload describes the amount of stretch or the amount of tension in the ventricles at the end of diastole. So preload is sort of has the same ratio as the amount as the end diastolic volume. So the amount of volume there is in the heart. So if your preload increases, then it's sort of trying to tell the clinician that there is more blood at the end of diastole, at the end of filling. Whereas afterload describes the resistance to the ventricular ejection. So the number that is sort of associated with afterload is the systolic blood pressure. So just vascular resistance. That's what I wanted to say. It's just vascular resistance. So what does the left or right ventricle need to overcome to effectively push blood out of its ventricle?
So I actually, that makes total sense. Thanks, Xiao. And I also know that preload and afterload are also related to terms like end diastolic volume and end systolic volume, which you actually mentioned. So preload is similar to end diastolic volume, which means after the heart has had time to fill with blood, how much blood actually remains before the heart can pump out that blood. And afterload is similar or is related to end systolic volume, where if you have a high afterload, you're going to have a high end systolic volume, which is basically how much blood actually remains in the chambers after the heart has squeezed or has tried to pump out blood. So how you were explaining, like if there's high systemic resistance, that means that the heart actually has to work much more harder to pump out that blood into the circulation that already has high pressure. So it's more likely that blood will actually remain in the chamber and not be effectively pumped out of the heart and into the circulation. So that makes total sense.
And actually, the funny thing is I've never heard of afterload being associated with the end systolic volume, because we talk so little about the end systolic volume, but you're absolutely right. Yeah. If there's lots of pressure in the systemic circulation or the pulmonary circulation as well, then the ventricle is going to have a harder time pushing out all that blood, so you're going to have more left over.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but by definition, afterload is just trying to give you a description or a descriptive word to the resistance that the ventricle needs to push against. That's basically the dictionary definition, I suppose. But that was a really good point that you bring up. So this sort of is a really nice place to move on towards pathophysiology. So basically, let's put our knowledge of how heart failure begins into how it presents in a patient. So a pump failure means that it's going to lead to a backlog. And the backlog basically is what creates all the systemic, the signs and symptoms that we as clinicians are looking for. So because there are two pumps, there are technically three types of failures that we can categorize. So we're going to go through the old categories of failures. So you've got right heart failure, left heart failure, and in the poor patients, some patients do present with both. So if your right pump is not working, that means that the blood in your right heart is not being pushed into the pulmonary system. So you're going to get a backlog in the systemic system. So that will lead to peripheral edema, distended jugular veins, elevated JVP, and then you can also get portal system backlogging. So that's things like enlarged liver, spleen, ascites. And because all your organs are so big, you can lose your appetite, you can get bloating, and of course, weight gain.
Basically, the way I kind of think about right pump failure is where the blood comes from into the right heart is kind of where it pulls into. So like blood will come from like the venous system, like the jugular veins, the portal system, the JVP, everything. And so when you have the right pump failure, all of that blood kind of pulls backwards, if that makes sense.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so with left pump, going on your ideas, so the left pump is supposed to push blood into the systemic system. It's no longer doing that. It's failing, so that now it's going to pull. Where is it going to pull? It's going to pull in the pulmonary system. So that's where you get liquid in your lungs, such as pulmonary edema or even pleural effusions. Then the patient will complain of dyspnea. They can look short of breath. They can look like they have increased work of breathing, and that can lead to hypoxia, coughing. And this pulmonary edema usually has a characteristically pink sputum. And I believe it's pink because it's actually the alveoli. The tissue of the alveoli is caused, you know, they're expectorating it now. So that's what gives it its pink color. And then you also hear this fine crackles that they like to say sounds like rubbing your hair together. Then you've got the patients who get both. So then you're looking for overload in systemic system and overload in the pulmonary system. Now, because your heart is really important to deliver nutrients to your tissues, when your tissues are really, really hypoxic or ischemic, they start releasing sort of chemicals that make you feel like you're really tired because they're not feeling great. They're basically undernourished. Your cells are undernourished. So in general, people with heart failure, especially decompensated heart failure, are really tired and are quite down. And one thing to look for is, unfortunately, these people present with depression as a comorbidity a lot of the times. And other signs that are linked to heart failure include displaced heartbeat as well as a third heart sounds. And these are characteristic of both left pump and right pump heart failure. So now you know the signs and symptoms of heart failure. The next step is diagnoses. So interestingly enough, heart failure is very much based on the clinician. And this is probably why there's subspecialty in cardiology all about heart failure. So heart failure is a clinical diagnosis. Yes, there are investigations that you can order that can support your diagnosis, but ultimately it's up to the clinician to label this condition. So the investigations that you might wish to order include the investigations that you would like to order may include a transthoracic echocardiogram. This will give you a really nice picture of whether what the ejection fraction is, as well as give you a diagnosis of HFpEF or HFrEF. And it can also give you an idea as to what the valves are doing. Chest x-ray is also really useful. It can look for pulmonary edema and it can also look for other differentials. ECG is always really nice. Serum BNP. BNP is B-type natriuretic peptide. Now this is the test that's really become very popular because it's really the definition of congestive heart failure. It's very specific and sensitive to congestive heart failure. Then as an outpatient, you can also perform a stress test. After diagnosing, it's also really important to ensure that your patient is classified in terms of severity. So one thing to get familiar with is the New York Heart Association's severity classification of heart failure. I really encourage you guys to look it up, but in general, class number one is no symptoms. Class number two is reduced physical capacity for moderate level of physical activity. Class three is reduced physical capacity for low level physical activity. So that's like shortness of breath on any types of exertion. So walking, maybe jogging. And class four is symptomatic even at rest. All right, let's take a pause here. And is there any questions out there?
So I have a question, Shel, from the audience. maybe it's not really a question, but it's more just kind of to kind of explain. Actually, it is a question, which we can probably have a discussion about. I might know some information, but is there any relationship between heart failure and kidney function or vice versa, like the cardiorenal syndrome? Have you heard of that?
Yeah, most definitely. So look, the kidneys are really sensitive to fluid. And the heart is basically the person that is also actually really sensitive to fluid. So basically, if there is, it's kind of like a chicken and egg problem, right? Because kidneys are trying to maintain the fluid balance level of the whole body. And the heart is trying to push it along to maintain homeostasis. And also to make sure the fluid and the nutrients is carried towards all its cells. So if the kidney fails and you get fluid retention, then your heart's going to really have a hard time pumping it, because now you've got a whole lot of fluid and that fluid's not really going anywhere. Your heart's going to have to push against that fluid, and it's going to add a lot of extra, like there's only so much that your vessels can compensate for. So it's going to increase your blood pressure, and that means it's going to put more strain on your heart, and that can cause heart failure. But at the same time, if you've got heart failure and your heart is unable to push blood effectively and you're getting all these leftover blood, then your kidney is going to perceive that you've got heaps of fluid in your body. And I think, look, you've just been in the renal ward, so you must have seen some people that presented to the renal ward but initially had cardiac failure.
Yeah, it's quite, like as you're saying, like they're quite related, because with heart failure, how you're saying, if the heart's not able to pump effectively, there may not be enough fluid or volume that's actually reaching the kidneys that can lead to the kidneys perceiving the blood pressure to be very low. And then that can kind of kickstart the RAS pathway, which can lead to fluid retention, which can actually put more stress on the heart and kind of worsen the heart failure symptoms, because the heart has more blood to kind of pump. And so the workload is high, the demand is high, but the actual resources are low to actually pump the blood. And the reason I asked this question was because I know serum BNP kind of acts in opposition to the RAS pathway, because the RAS pathway helps to increase blood pressure, but BNP is released to help decrease blood pressure by kind of opposing the RAS pathway. So I guess that was just my question. Like, from that, would serum BNP be higher or lower in someone who has heart failure?
And kidney disease, is that what you're asking?
Not and kidney disease, but as a result of the RAS pathway kind of kicking in.
That's a really good question. I think serum BNP by definition is, if it's high, then you're more likely to rule in congestive heart failure.
Okay. Yep. That makes sense.
I'm not necessarily sure on the particulars about how the RAS system works in conjunction with BNP and whether it will give you a completely separate result if there is a kidney problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a really good thing to look up. And, you know, listeners out there, like, let us know if you find the answer.
Absolutely.
Anyways, I shall leave it here. So I've given you a quick summary. Well, we've done an in-depth discussion, more like an in-depth discussion on the physiology, pathoetiology, and pathophysiology of congestive heart failure, as well as the diagnostic tests and severity classifications. In the next episode, we shall jump into management of a chronic condition, as well as investigation and management of acute decompensations, and have a chat about the importance of maintenance and the importance and what to do as a clinician looking after acute on chronic conditions, which I think is something quite novel as a medical student.
Yep. No, thank you so much, Shah. This is actually really, really helpful. And I love how you actually broke it down based on like what's the heart's function and what happens when the heart is not able to function, whether it's relating to filling or squeezing. So it's a very good summary. Thank you so much. Now to our listeners, if you have any questions, please feel free to send us an email at minimedpods@gmail.com. Or you can send us a message on Facebook. We're also on Facebook. Our Facebook page is MiniMedPods. And stay tuned for more episodes and for part 2 of congestive heart failure.
Thank you so much, guys. Bye-bye.